Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Companies editor Mark Robinson. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Excellent. Settling into the new role?
Just about, yeah. As you know, we've had the 350 review this week.
Baptism of fire?
Of sorts. Yeah, no, it was fine, really. But I've been in the US for about 10 days and I came back and I hadn't really got into gear.
No, we didn't get into gear in the US either.
No.
Stuck in a snowbob on a motor, well, on a freeway.
Yeah, it wasn't a relaxing holiday by any means.
There you go. And Emma Powell, news editor Emma Powell, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. So, yes, we're going to talk about the FTSE 350 review, which is our big annual look at the largest companies listed on the UK market. It's a 40-page standalone supplement where we look at every sector and many of the companies within them. And you had the unenviable task of putting this all together this year.
It was a great pleasure, actually. There's some really interesting stuff in this year as well, including the usual rundown on valuations from James Norrington, which our readers will find most helpful, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a great piece. I'm always really, really proud of this. I think the team's done a fantastic job again this year. We will talk about a couple of the specific sectors and some broader points, broader observations that you've made. Before we do that, Emma, we haven't had a good news roundup for a few weeks. You've written the only feature in the rest of the mag as well, which is another look at outsourcing in the wake of the Carillion saga.
Yes.
So let's start with the news pages. What have you got for us this week?
Yeah, lots of profit warnings this week. So maybe we could start with Dignity. That was about a 40% drop. Obviously, Dignity is the funeral package provider. We have it on a sell tip. But yeah, there's massive share fall. Basically, they're warning of lots of pricing competition from people like the Co-op, lots of other supermarkets. I believe Sainsbury's does a funeral package now.
Dignity is as you say, Emma, it's one that we'd been keeping an eye on for a while. We did worry about the model. We worried about the competition. And we worried about the high level of debt that they seem to have taken on in their buy and build strategy.
Well, yeah, exactly. And they've actually now, not only have they had to implement price cuts, obviously, to you know, try and keep up with the competition, it also means that they expect their market share now to decline too. So not good news. And unsurprisingly, we've kept it on a sell.
I mean, these shares don't look overly expensive, but we think there's worse to come. They're still not the cheapest funeral option on the market, so...
Not by a long shot. And you know, if you think, you know, we've started to see a bit of competition coming through, they're already cutting prices, but even after the price cuts, they're still not going to be the cheapest. So I definitely think more bad news to come on that one.
And to think at one stage, this stock was seen as a banker for many years, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it was always highly rated, but there was good reason for that.
No, absolutely. This was a stock market darling. And I mean, you do wonder, though, you know, the buy and build strategy, when a company's organic growth is starting to flag, then, you know, supplementing that growth with acquisitions is often a way companies go, but it can disguise a problem. And that seems to be the case here. And with the debt where it is, there's no way they can now buy themselves out of it.
Well, exactly.
Okay, so bad news at Dignity. Where else have we had profit warnings? M Brown, I noticed.
M Brown, which was on a sell tip, and we actually moved to a hold. The issue with M Brown, actually, is that it's been growing in one area, its financial services part of the business, but not in the retail space. And that's been the real worry. So basically, they issued the profit warning because the contraction in the gross margins for the retail business is actually expected to be worse than expected. And actually, the margin improvement for the financial services business is going to be better than expected. Now, you might think that is that balancing it out? Surely it's good news, you know, that they're having this margin expansion in financial services. But actually, no, because I think people are very worried about the rate at which the lending at their financial services business is increasing. If you then put that against the backdrop of this massive surge in consumer credit and how viable that is to keep going. So I think that's definitely where a lot of the kind of concerns around M Brown center. And again, there was a fall of about 15% in the shares on the day.
Yeah, indeed. Both those companies on the 7 days page in the worst fallers of the week, along with Carpet Riot as well, which is not in the mag.
Yeah, not in the mag. But I mean, that was, you know, that they've had profit warnings. I think it was last October. They kind of first flagged that there was issues there. Again, discretionary spend down. And that's what they blame that on.
Permanent issues at Carpet Riot, as far as I'm concerned. I've had that on a sale when I was covering retail almost more than half a decade ago.
Well, if you look historically as well, carpet retailers and gymnasiums are always stand as bellwethers for sort of bear markets.
It's funny enough because I'm in the market for a lot of carpet at the moment. Not buying it at carpet right now. Buying it from the guy down the road, which I think actually might be another big trend in retail. Shop locally. The other big forwarder of the week was Countrywide. Again, I'm not sure we've got this in the mag. Have we got this in the mag?
Yeah, it's a tip update.
Oh, yes, it is a tip update, isn't it? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Countrywide, again, transaction volumes down, so obviously profits down, and actually...
Countrywide being an estate agent.
Yes, sorry. And unsurprisingly, a fellow sell tip, actually today, the day we're recording this podcast, Foxtons has issued, again, a trading update saying that transaction volumes are down, so revenues are down. Luckily, we have got those both on sell tips then, as I said.
Perma sales have been for quite some time. And let's finish the news off on another bum note. And a bum note this time for the bookies. This is the lead story this week. Rumours leaking out about the government's review of the fixed odds betting terminal industry. And it doesn't look good for the bookies.
No, it doesn't. So obviously this is the review into fixed odds betting terminals, otherwise known as the crack cocaine of gambling, where obviously the government is considering whether to reduce the maximum stake. So at the moment it's £100, to reduce that to either 50, 30 or £2. Then those reports from the Sunday Times initially, a leak from government supposedly about the Matt Hancock, the culture secretary, actually thinking about cutting the maximum stake to £2, which would obviously be very bad for some bookies. William Hill in particular, because it's got a very big high street presence. Shares in William Hill actually fell 13%, and in all the other bookies as well, but to a slightly lesser extent.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can really complain about a cut in the cap on fixed odds betting terms to £2 a spin. You can still spend a lot of money.
Exactly, but, yeah. It's just designed to slow people down, though.
Yeah, I really don't like these things. But the industry has they've been a real profit driver for the bookies. Is there anyone we like left in the sector? GVC, I think, springs to mind.
GVC, yes. We actually recently tipped GVC. And obviously, that's in the midst of a takeover, of a merger with Ladbrokes Coral. But actually, the way that deal was kind of structured is actually quite good, because they took into account the fact that this review was obviously going through. So, you know, we've got Ladbrokes Coral, which admittedly is highly exposed itself, but obviously it's thinking about taking over GVC. The deal still looks likely to go through, just because obviously the diversification benefits, but the actual deal includes loan notes, which would rise and fall depending on the outcome of this, or become worthless, actually, in the event of a £2 stake, in the event that it is cut to £2, which would mean that Ladbrokes shareholders get less, but we're still kind of positive on the deal overall in terms of diversifying those two, which are both buy tips.
Indeed, but I noticed from the piece that, you know, were they to remain independent, you know, a £2 stake on FOBTs would hit their profits by 62%.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
it would be very bad.
It's a huge thing.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer that this deal goes through, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, all shareholders would want it to go through.
Absolutely. It's a tough time to be a bookie, and that's not something you hear very often. Okay, let's move on from the news. Let's talk FTSE 350 review. So, Robbo, tell us about your sort of broad thoughts of what we've seen, what we can expect in the year ahead.
Okay, well, what's interesting about the performance of the 350 over the last year or so, we know that it's underperformed a number of its overseas rivals, the DAX, the CAC 40, the S&P, and there's obviously good reasons for this as well. Chief amongst them is that UK indices, in particular the UK benchmark 100, always move within a narrower band than the overseas comparators. And I think looking forward for investors, this is not a bad thing. In fact, many analysts are pointing to the UK as being a relatively good value set against our overseas rivals. Now, the valuations on offer within the FTSE 350 are not sustainable, or at least are not explicable in terms of their underlying earnings performance, particularly when you take into consideration the high levels of buybacks and the influence of sterling's devaluation over the last year or so. But again, relative to our overseas competitors, the FTSE 100, the 250, and therefore the 350 are looking pretty good value. The whole index itself rose by about 8% through 2017, which is in line with the benchmark increase as well. And that, you know, obviously is, you know, it's heavily weighted towards that.
So what did good, what did well, what did badly last year? I mean, let's have a look at the, on a sector by sector basis. I mean, the big winner, looking at this, was mining.
Yeah, and there's good reason for this as well. I've just got some figures in front of me here. If you go right through industrial metals, you're looking at about a 20% or 21% rise for aluminium, copper.
So it's driven by the underlying the value of the underlying commodities.
Yes, that's right. And iron ore is trading at about $72 a ton at the moment for 62% fines. But we can't expect that to last through 2018. The Australian government have come out and said that they expect iron ore prices to reduce by about 20% on average through this year. So, and that's partly as a result as China continues to rationalise its steel industry. In fact, last year was a record year for iron ore imports into China. That won't be replicated through this year.
Mm.
But the miners themselves will actually still perform reasonably well, we think. And part of this is, I was talking to Alex Newman, our mining correspondent, about this. And the miners now, and in fact resource companies in general, are benefiting from the programs that are undertaken after the huge increase in commodity prices in the early part of the millennium as well. What happened, as we all know, is there was the huge write-offs across the sector, oil and gas and mining, and basically the companies then had to rationalise their cost base, get rid of non-performing assets and marginal assets. They've done that, and so they're in a much better position now to generate free cash flow, and they bolstered their dividends and their ability to sustain these dividends, even the likes of BHP Billiton, which was under some pressure there. So they're looking much better from that perspective, and therefore that should underpin their valuations going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex is relatively confident in this sector. I mean, his tip of the year came from this sector.
Well, exactly, and it is because of these rationalisation measures that have been put in place over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
So they're just in much better shape operationally than they were before the crash, as it were.
Yeah, but they were profligate in those years, buying assets at the top of the market. And again, it comes back to the issue that we talked about the magazine perpetually, and that's distorted incentives for directors. The directors are just looking to boost the top line and earnings.
And pay packets.
Pay packets, exactly, because, I mean, you know, the incentives are very often linked to earnings.
Funnily enough, we have in our No Free Lunch column this week, Paul Jackson's looked at Persimmon and the share scheme there, and how you know, this scheme has created just extraordinary payouts for its directors.
Yeah, I think Paul's like a dog with a bone in its mouth with this one, but I mean,
he's right.
Well, of course.
This has really upset quite a lot of people.
No, it's very insightful stuff. I mean, all strength to him as well. I remember our former colleague Alistair Blair was very strong on this as well, and as we are advocates for the retail investor, I think we should pursue this line.
Absolutely. Let's head back to the FTSE 3 for the review. Let's look at the other end, which this is what you've written about in your intro to the piece. So the worst performing sector is fixed line telecoms, and yeah, this is a handful of stocks, BT, TalkTalk, that have had specific issues. But the second worst performer, and it's a more general sector thing, is oil equipment and services. They have had a nightmare. And this is probably not the worst year.
Well, it isn't the worst year, but then again, it has to be said that 2016 was a kind of recovery year for them, or a partial recovery. But I mean, we're talking everything's in reference to a low base here. The point I make in the introduction as well is that I've highlighted two sectors which I think could actually outperform through this year, and oil services is one of them. And again, it's linked to the reasons that I've just outlined as well. The fact that oil capital budgets are at least flatline and maybe starting to retrace a little bit now after the collapse in oil prices midway through 2014.
So you had a collapse in oil prices, the big producers basically turned off a lot of capex, and this hit the oil equipment market hardest of all.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, oil service companies had to rely on their OPEX budgets to a large degree during this fall away, because well commence initiations and finishes reduced dramatically during this period, and certain sectors like even onshore US or North American shale, the well count fell dramatically there. This hits certain of the companies within the sector, one of our favourites, Hunting, quite hard, because they, in their case, they provide a lot of the fracking equipment, specialist fracking equipment. But now what we're seeing is that budgets are starting to retrace, albeit slowly. The Trump administration has signaled one of the largest expansions of offshore drilling capacity, I guess, since the Reagan administration. Alex has been talking to certain industry figures about the appetite for that, and it is mixed. But we think, at the very least, with oil services, that market has bottomed out, and we're going to see some gradual recovery in the share price as a result. The other area that I've noted, which and Emma might have some thoughts on this, because it's a sector that she's intimately aware of, is banking, and UK banking in particular, because you look at it now, and after many years, again, it's another sector that's been under the cosh and is still encumbered by regulatory issues going forward.
Yeah, I mean, look at the performance of the banking sector in 2017. The sector was up 11.3%, mid-table obscurity, but not a performance to be scoffed at, really, given the backdrop. Tell us what's been going on in banking, Emma.
Yeah, well, I think the reason for a lot of the gains this year is, well, twofold, really. Firstly, you've got banks like Barclays and also RBS, to a certain extent, who've really cleaned up a lot of their balance sheets. So with Barclays, obviously, they sold off Barclays Africa. They've managed to get rid of a lot of the risk-weighted assets to do with their non-core business, which has obviously helped then conversely boost their common tier 1 equity ratio, which is obviously vital for their ability to pay dividends. RBS, again, even though, I mean, we still have this bank on a hold, it's actually an outsider for us within the sector, it's kind of got rid, again, of a lot of the risk-weighted assets to do with its bad bank, which is Capital Resolution, it calls it. So again, it's had a really good improvement in its capital levels. And then I think you've got other banks, so Standard Chartered and HSBC, which are obviously very much emerging markets, Asia focused. They've done very well as sentiment towards emerging markets has improved. I know people were quite cautious, particularly when Trump came in with a lot of his kind of protectionism and kind of inflation expectations, that maybe emerging markets would suffer and we'd see loads of outflows. That hasn't happened, actually. Emerging market has continued to recover. Sentiment has continued to recover kind of post 2015, 2016. So that's been good. And yet again, obviously, HSBC has been able to maintain its dividend, kind of like the dividend king of the sector.
Barclays had a bad year from a share price perspective. I mean, the shares got cheaper as the year progressed. Why was the sort of action they were taking to streamline the business not translating into a better share price performance?
They've still obviously got the investment banking part of their business. Now, I think, I mean, obviously that's kind of divided shareholders over whether they should have just gone down the Lloyd's route, which is to just have a kind of UK, very retail-focused business.
But Lloyd's weren't exactly stellar last year, the shares. I mean,
no, they're very steady, but I'd argue, you know, you don't buy Lloyd's for growth, you buy Lloyd's for income, really, because it's come good on its promise to keep progressing its dividend, and that's why I think people have bought into Lloyd's, and it's not actually that expensive for the income on offer. But I think Barclays, what sometimes its investment bank has really kind of helped push up its net interest margin as a whole, obviously because interest rates are so low within the UK, and kind of the returns you can make on just plain old retail banking are quite low. But in other respects, you've seen actually an increase in them having to take provisions for bad debts or impairments on their credit card business in the US in particular, and also just with the investment banking, it's a lot more kind of up and down. So I think during the third quarter last year, it really damaged returns for them.
What do we make of the Challenger Bank's prospects? I mean, they've been an exciting area, lots of new challenges. I mean, this is a bigger sector now than it has been for a long time. It used to be, you know, just the biggies. It's one of the biggest sectors now.
Well, yeah, exactly. Within the FTSE 350, you've got Virgin Money, Close Brothers, Aldermore. Obviously, Aldermore has been subject to a takeover.
Plant Savings, Metro Bank. I mean, it's an amazing sector now.
Yeah, and you know, they've really done amazingly well when you look at, you know, them compared to the major lenders, the kind of returns on equity they offer, which, you know, in the case of Close Brothers can be in the 20s%. Their loan books are just growing so rapidly. I guess the question would be, can they continue this rapid loan growth? In recent years, well, the past kind of 2 years, they've been able to take advantage of the term funding scheme, which is something that Bank of England set up, basically allowing them to borrow money at the base rate. It was intended to kind of combat that ultra low interest rate environment, but you know, that closes in February this year. You can draw as much money you want, I guess, to kind of keep lending and keep propelling your loan, you know, your loan books, particularly in asset finance, squeeze margins, and you know, there's a lot of increased competition in that area. But the question is, obviously, when that source of cheap funding goes, actually, are you going to be able to keep growing your loan book so much? I mean, the other thing is they're really exposed to buy to let in terms of One Savings Bank. So if you believe that the rapidly rising buy to let market, if some of the steam's going to come out of that, they're very highly geared to that.
Yeah, well, certainly the government's made it a lot more difficult for new lenders.
Yeah, I think the market's already in trouble, to be honest.
It is, but as far as I understand it, these guys are more interested in the more professional buy-to-let landlord who can cope with the regulatory and taxation changes
exactly.
Much more effectively.
Yeah, so exactly. So people like Paragon as well, which obviously is again, actually, yeah, in the FTSE 350 and One Savings Bank, their argument management is always that we deal with the complex applications of professional landlords, and obviously the Prudential Regulatory Authority in September did introduce new requirements for underwriting standards for those kind of complex mortgages, and they'd say, you know, we have a lot of expertise in that area, so we're perfectly placed to pick up on that. I mean, as it goes, you know, a lot of these kind of guys have recently had trading updates for the end of last year. Buy to let is still doing really, really well. I've got other kind of opinions on asset finance, which some of them are in, because I think the margin pressure going on there is unsustainable. And I think that could be a worry. People like Close Brothers have tried to get out of that because of that. But they have become more highly rated because of the growth on offer. Whether they can sustain that is another question.
The analyst outlook on Barclays seems to be polarised at the moment. I was looking at some analysis through this week and they seem to be rather at odds. But what's the general feeling on income prospects for the sector at the moment? Because there was some speculation that RBS might come back into the fold.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing with RBS, I have seen that where people are a bit more positive on income prospects. The big thing with RBS is they've still obviously got, they still haven't resolved this settlement with the DOJ in America. You know, they were hoping to kind of finalise that settlement before the end of last year. They haven't done that yet. So for me, more than any other bank, obviously RBS has been mired in legal disputes. So you don't know the size of the provision they're going to have to take against that. Or, you don't know how that's going to affect their capital
ratio. We're still not
quite
sure when that's going to come to light either.
Exactly. What's kept me, I know our tips editor, Algie Hall, has some kind of differing opinions on RBS to me, because, you know, the shares have come back. For me, it's just too much of an uncertain one.
Okay, interesting. Let's talk outsourcing. Now, you didn't write the piece for the FTSE 350 review, but you've revisited, as I said, the sector this week in a feature for the magazine. And really kind of looking at some of the kind of more detailed financials behind the sector to understand, you know, what the prospects of recovery here are.
Yeah.
Talk us through the areas you've looked at.
Well, there's a few areas. I mean, I think the accounts of outsourcers are fascinating in lots of ways. And when you examine them, you do kind of realise that a lot of the reasons kind of Carillion blew up, even though it's important to say that the government has said that, you know, while they have a lot of these companies, the outsourcers they use on a kind of health watch, they don't think any are in a comparable position. But when you look at the accounts, you can actually see a lot of common trends coming through. So one might be and this won't be a surprise to investors in Interserve, or Mighty indeed, there's a lot of kind of rising one-off items, which is very interesting to look at. You know, people like Mighty and Interserve in particular, if you look at kind of one-off items, you know, exceptional
what
items.
Like restructuring costs?
So restructuring costs, provisions they've had to take against...
So these are on contracts that have gone...
Contracts that haven't made as much money as they thought.
Yep.
Contracts they might have had to have exited, like in Interserve case, the Energy for Waste contract, which mm-hmm. has obviously been a massive, massive problem for them. And then obviously in like Capita's case, it could be for business restructuring costs because they're constantly splicing their business up and selling off businesses.
It goes back to that point we mentioned earlier about buy and build. So Capita has been a buy and build model. Mighty has been a buy and build model.
Yeah.
And arguably that has obscured some of the realities of underlying trading.
Yeah, I think Capita actually is the... probably one of the best examples of this in the outsourcing sector. You know, for the past decade, they've kind of organic growth has been very inconsistent if you look at it. And obviously the initial profit warning in 2016, part of that was, you know, organic growth is going to be lower. But actually, if you look back across the past decade, it's been very, very inconsistent. But what they've done is they've kept acquiring so many businesses. So they've acquired loads of businesses and then they've constantly changed their divisional structure. So it's also means it's very hard to actually compare like for like each year for shareholders. But another consequence of that is that they've also then incurred loads of restructuring costs. So had to, you know, write off contracts associated with certain businesses because actually, you know, it hasn't been as valuable as they thought it would be, a certain acquisition or whatever. So that's really interesting. Again, and also meant that their debt has gone up and up and up, which also is kind of a vicious circle because it means you can no longer keep just making acquisitions to sustain your growth.
Exactly what we talked about with Dignity. Yeah. Let's talk about the other metric, the other couple of metrics, in fact, you look at. Accrual rates are interesting. So accrual rates are basically money you are waiting to receive from your clients.
Exactly. So you might book it as revenue, but you haven't actually received the cash. I mean, this is a major kind of structural issue, I think, with outsourcers, which just makes the business model a lot riskier because their contracts are so long term. So, you know, you can say, I think I'm going to have this much revenue from this contract. You book it. But actually, it might turn out that, A, you know, you don't receive as much money for it as you think you're going to get. Or sometimes, actually, you actually can't complete the contract for the amount of money you thought you could. Because obviously, you know, across the outsourcing sector, I think everyone's just competing for, you know, the same contract. So it's going lower and lower and lower. But going back to the issue of the receivables to revenue, I mean, you look at a company like Interserve, also Capita, they've got some of the highest accrual rates in the sector if you go past over the past decade, which just again, you know, creates an element of risk there because it just means, you know, you're never quite certain actually what you've got coming in.
Yeah, well, I mean, cash is something I know you're particularly obsessed with, Robbo.
Yeah, well, is this interesting?
Rightly so.
Yes, because, I mean, we've had some major reforms to the way that companies have to account for their sales, which would feed into cash flow statements this year. IFRS 15 comes to mind, and I don't know if that had any bearing on what's happened recently with Carillion. But we're expecting some surprises in the upcoming results season on that basis.
Okay, so that could have an effect on the financial reports coming out of some of these companies.
Yeah, I have no doubt in the weeks and months ahead.
Okay, this sector sounds like it has some problems to overcome, some kind of underlying challenges which are quite challenging. Is there any hope that these companies can mount a turnaround, get themselves in better financial shape?
The immediate response for a lot of these companies, Mighty, Capita, Interserve, has been, right, let's cut costs. Okay, so it's like, okay, you can do that. And obviously that's what we kind of saw with G4S and Serco. They really stripped back their focus because, again, they were like these sprawling giants. So they really stripped back their focus and said, right, we're going to concentrate on UK. Those companies have seen a bit of an improvement. But
I think you mentioned that they basically got out of a lot of contracts that were losing the money. So.
Yeah, which obviously you have to take provisions against.
Once it's done, it's done.
Yeah, you could see that as a short-term hit. But for me, really, why I think we're bearish on this on this sector is it's just the fundamental problem of actually how are you making money in this sector. You know, the work is so low margin, most of it, you know, it's cleaning contracts and things like that. It does seem, and even actually Rupert Soames, chief exec of Serco, when he took over, he said the problem was is that we were just bidding in for so much work, just trying to win it almost at any cost, rather than thinking I need to win work that's going to be profitable. That's the real, real issue for these outsourcers. Yeah, you know, you can take the short term hits and think, yeah, I'm going to reduce my debt, which is obviously good. I'm going to, you know, get out of a lot of these bad contracts, but you've actually got to be able to make money going forward. And if it's just a race to the bottom and everyone's bidding in at any cost, you know, how are you actually going to do that? Margins are so weak in this sector.
It's a strange old thing. Outsourcing. There's a popular narrative out there that outsourcers are basically raping the public purse and making huge amounts of money out of public services, but they're not.
They're not making a lot of money.
You know, you hear the idea, you know, PFIs, okay, some companies may have done very well out of that, but the idea that, that these companies are making huge amounts of money at the expense of the taxpayer, just sort of doesn't stand up to scrutiny here.
No, it's incredibly, incredibly low margin work.
Yeah, I find it very odd. The fact that it's low margin work is why we avoid most of the companies in the sector. That's not the case for all companies in the sector. Babcock, we've talked about it a number of times in recent weeks, but it's targeting very specialist outsourcing services.
I think that's the key, isn't it? Specialisation is the key, because
it's high barrier to entry as well. So if you're doing a lot of work, you know, on behalf of the MOD and things like that, that's why, actually, I think Babcock is the only company, the only outsourcer we have on a buy, because it's very high barrier to entry work. And it also, for that reason, you know, you look at its free cash flow conversion is very good. Its debt's been quite steady, but, you know, it's not going down the facilities management kind of low margin route that Mitie and Interserve have done. It is kind of nuclear decommissioning work and, you know, defence work, which is, you know, high barrier to entry. You've differentiated yourself.
Yeah.
You've got companies from a slightly different sector, Amec Foster Wheeler, who are in decommissioning as well. And as you say, this isn't open to everyone. You have to have specialist skills, and it's much easier as a result then to get some clarity on the pricing question.
I think it's what Warren Buffett might have called a moat. It's a defensible position that these companies have.
Okay.
It means they can protect their margins.
And I think there's more flexibility, inbuilt flexibility with MOD, with a lot of MOD contracts as well, especially for hardware.
Okay, there you go. All right, well, that's a very brief look at a couple of sectors in the FTSE 350. If we sat here and went through them all, we would be here till tomorrow morning. So we won't do that today. I will just encourage you all to go away and read it and keep it on your desk all year. We produce it as a standalone supplement, so you can do that and refer back to it and some of the numbers that we put in there as well.
Well, it'll be interesting a year from now what we'll be saying as well. But there's a couple other points I'd make as well in terms of the valuations. In the early part of this year, the sterling has appreciated against the dollar quite significantly, and that's obviously going to feed into earnings for 350 companies as well. I think something like 78% of earnings for the FTSE 100 companies are denominated in overseas currencies, predominantly the dollar, so that's going to have a major effect on earnings.
And assuming it sticks at this level, but
yeah, I know.
You never know with currencies these days.
Well, exactly.
It may bring.
If this is part of a trend, that's something to look at. Another area as well is sort of 10-year T-bills. I think the main risk to valuations in the market at the moment, which are very difficult to support from a fundamental level, the main danger is with interest rates, and the majority of fund managers in the US and in this country as well would see this as the prime risk factor to valuations. If 10-year T-bills as well, if they move up to 3 to 3.5%, then that constitutes a major danger for equity values.
Okay, well, we'll have to keep an eye out for that. Okay, thank you, Robbo. Thank you, Emma. Plenty more in the magazine this week. The results section is a little bit bigger than it was previous week, and it's going to get busier still as we're starting to crank up towards results season.
Yes, so, lots of pre-close closing updates today, so yeah. As Emma mentioned before. So.
No rest for the wicked, eh? No rest for the wicked. The usual tips, the usual comments and tip updates. We have a stock screen from Algie Hall, the Have It All stock screen, which is a pretty tremendous performer, and Harriet Russell has revisited the High Street updates we've been talking about for the past few weeks in the Sector Focus. So anyway, thank you all for listening. Pick up the magazine in all good newsagents, the FTSE 350 review. As I say, we've got a 40-page pullout. So it was a big old effort this week, so well done to everybody. And we'll be back next week. Speak soon. Goodbye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.